Well, I am in the unenviable position of being the proverbial thing that stands between you and dinner. And as I've been reflecting on such a terrific day, the image that keeps coming to mind is that this is what you might describe as a Super Bowl of reason. And I can't help but feeling a lot like the water boy at this point. Professor Tollefson's case for the way in which a natural law conception of the state might ground social justice for the profoundly disabled, and by extension, those who care for them, is rich and compelling. In fact, Tollefson's perspective is arguably so persuasive that any sober-minded respondent would be ill-advised to do anything other than to invoke the political finesse of Pontius Pilate. I find no fault in this man, or more precisely, this man's argument. But knowing how things ended for Jesus, and having no intention of pronouncing political condemnation on Tollefson's work, I have decided to pass over Pilate's proclamation in order to do what all clever respondents ought to do when, like me, they find themselves in substantial agreement with the essay upon which they've been asked to offer critical reflection. I'm going to change the subject. Tollefson's argument for his main claim that social justice for the disabled is best grounded in a teleological view of the state is simple and elegant. And in presenting it in its simplicity, I do not intend to be reductionistic. In fact, I hope that I have actually accurately characterize his position. The state exists to make human flourishing feasible, since the goods constitutive of human flourishing cannot be procured individually. Crucially, Tollefson defends this claim with his discussion of the problem of self-sufficiency and the manner in which it parallels the circumstances of the profoundly disabled. As human beings, the profoundly disabled have needs of flourishing that are identical with those of any other human being. Therefore, the state exists to make human flourishing feasible for the profoundly disabled, and not merely those persons who, by virtue of autonomy and rationality, are capable of entering into the social contract. In advancing this argument, Tollefson relies on the crucial connection between our universal inadequacy, qua human beings, to secure the goods constitutive of human flourishing, and the particular dependency of the profoundly disabled in securing the same. Tollefson explains, quote, "All are inadequate in some respect or other for their own flourishing. All lack self-sufficiency in regards to the conditions necessary for them to achieve the level of well-being they are capable of," end quote. Hence, the state exists. As simple, elegant, and attractive as this argument is, I want to explain why I believe that liberal theorists, like Nussbaum, might have reasonable grounds for rejecting it. In doing so, I am not aiming to undermine Tollefson's case by pointing out what, in another argumentative context, the philosopher Alvin Plantinga called a flaw in the ointment. On the contrary, to the extent that Tollefson's analysis of traditional political liberalism's inability to ground social justice for the disabled is correct, as I believe it is, his positive proposal to ground social justice for the disabled in natural law thinking about the state is precisely the kind of salve that our irritated and sometimes irritating public discourse about such matters so desperately needs. However, if I am correct, the remedy that Tollefson is offering comes at a price that your average secularist is unwilling to pay. And here is my thesis. This is really the substance of my response. Specifically, the reasonableness of Tollefson's argument is ultimately rooted in a distinctly Christian eschatology. Thus, its reasonableness cannot fully and finally be grasped in the absence of a prior commitment to such an eschatology. Now, in demonstrating this, I hope to illuminate key differences between Nussbaum's approach and Tollefson's, with a view towards suggesting something about the limits of natural law reasoning when it comes to grounding social justice for the disabled. Now, I should point out, too, that the limits that I'm describing here are not general or broad limits that apply to all forms of natural law arguments. Rather, this point is restricted to this particular issue, which I think is a kind of unique case. Recall that Tollefson's argument depends crucially on the claim that the lack of self-sufficiency in securing the goods constitutive of human flourishing on the part of the profoundly disabled is the same, that's the key word, as a comparable lack of self-sufficiency on the part of any other fully abled human being at any number of stages in his or her life. Importantly, whatever differences exist are matters of degree and not of kind. Therefore, since the state exists to make human flourishing feasible and the profoundly disabled are fully human, the state exists to make flourishing for the disabled feasible. It seems to me that the secular liberal theorist, even one genuinely sympathetic to the needs of the disabled, would simply deny that Tollefson's claim for the lack of self-sufficiency on the part of the fully abled is the same, either in degree or kind, as the lack of self-sufficiency on the part of the disabled. Moreover, it seems that this denial need not necessarily rest on a fundamentally different conception of human personhood. In other words, the secular liberal theorist could, it seems, accept Tollefson's view of the disabled as human beings, while simultaneously denying the logic of Tollefson's argument. Recall that for Tollefson, being a member of the human species is sufficient for being a human person. This is because, as Tollefson puts it, quote, members of the human species have a radical capacity for free action and thought, even if by disease, genetic impairment, or environmental causes, some particular human being or other is rendered unable to actualize that radical capacity, end quote. Thus, Tollefson defends the full personhood of the profoundly disabled on the basis of their possession of a fully latent, albeit thwarted, teleology, one that, like the fully abled human being, is grounded in their very biological constitution. And of course, this is a point that gets a great deal of development in the book that Tollefson co-wrote called Embryo with Professor George. While the secular liberal might agree with Tollefson's defense of the full humanity of the disabled, that is, as a member of the human species, he need not accept his claim that the lack of self-sufficiency in securing the goods constitutive of human flourishing on the part of the profoundly disabled is the same as a comparable lack of self-sufficiency on the part of any other fully abled human being. Here's why. First, while all human beings, quote, lack self-sufficiency in regards to the conditions necessary for them to achieve the level of well-being they are capable of, close quote, the fully abled are, from the standpoint of what I will call a secular eschatology, capable of a kind of relative self-sufficiency that the profoundly disabled are not. And I'll say more in a moment about that notion of a secular eschatology. Specifically, the fully abled are capable of becoming citizens, of assuming the responsibilities that are associated with ordering political authority so as to secure the level of human flourishing of which they are capable. Second, notice that from the standpoint of a secular eschatology, the profoundly disabled are simply not capable of this same kind of relative self-sufficiency, even if one accepts their full humanity on the basis of Tollefson's latent teleology. This is because, in the ordinary case, the lack of this relative self-sufficiency on the part of a fully abled human being at, let us say, the embryonic or early infant stage is merely temporary. Whereas in the case of the profoundly disabled, the lack of this same relative self-sufficiency is permanent, a fact that is grounded in the permanently thwarted biological teleology itself. Therefore, it seems reasonable for the secularist to deny that the kind of self-sufficiency that the fully abled human beings lack at various stages of their existence is the same as that of the disabled. Now, at this point, let me anticipate a potential rejoinder by Tolleson and explain why it ultimately does not succeed before drawing out some closing implications. By way of responding to our imagined secularist, Tolleson might be tempted to argue as follows. The fact that the internal biological teleology in the profoundly disabled is, quote, permanently thwarted, is irrelevant to the determination of whether the profoundly disabled are humans, and, as a consequence, whether the profoundly disabled thereby have at least some needs for goods that are constitutive of human flourishing. The fact that they do, coupled with the fact that, just like the fully abled, the disabled are inadequate to secure those goods independently, is sufficient to ground social justice for the disabled. As tempting as this response might be, it is ultimately undesirable, or at least so I think. Perhaps during Q&A, Professor Tolleson will tell me why it's not undesirable. For it is arguably rooted, and although I'm not going to try to make this argument full and clear now, it's arguably rooted in a larger theoretical framework according to which our obligations with regard to distributive justice are a function of the actual natural capacities of those living organisms who are members of some relevant ecological community. And let me note that in using the phrase ecological community, I'm not referring to the kind of moral ecology that was described earlier. I'm literally speaking of a kind of bioecological system. And my hypothesis is that such a theoretical framework is not sufficient to ground the kind of social justice for the disabled that Tolleson or any person of goodwill toward human beings has in mind. For on this view, justice, or giving each what is due, is a direct function of membership in a biological or natural kind. And the mere fact of differences between kinds does not, in and of itself, justify differences in the manner in which we treat members of distinct kinds. Taken to its logical end, this view would entail an obligation of social justice for all biological or natural kinds, in keeping with their respective natures, and more importantly, it would fail to offer any grounds for distinction in treatment of differing natural kinds. Thus, in itself, such a theory would not enable us to give preference to the needs of human flourishing for the disabled over a lame horse or a diseased oak tree. And I take it that unless one is persuaded by Peter Singer's diatribes about speciesism, this would be an unwelcome result. My point here is simple. Mere membership in the human species is not by itself sufficient to demonstrate Tolleson's case for social justice for the disabled from a natural law perspective. In addition to the claim of belonging to the humankind, one must also say, or perhaps presuppose, something about why membership in the human species is special. Interestingly, both Tolleson and Nussbaum do. But whereas Nussbaum is explicit, Tolleson's presupposition lies beneath the surface of his argument. And I want to close by drawing out their respective views and indicating what this implies for the limits of natural law reasoning about social justice for the disabled. Tolleson puzzles over why, quote, Nussbaum's concern for the disabled still seem fundamentally framed as concerns of citizenship, close quote. If my analysis is right, there is no puzzle whatsoever. Just like Tolleson, Nussbaum's view of the significance of human beings is grounded in her eschatology. That is, Nussbaum thinks about the significance of human beings in terms of what they might become. For Nussbaum, earthly citizenship is the eschatological fulfillment of the potential that is latent in the biological nature of a fully abled human being. Thus, if the physical possibility of reaching that eschatological target has been permanently and irreversibly thwarted, as in the case of the profoundly disabled, one cannot rationally regard such beings as members of the polis, or of the human community, even if they are biologically human. This is because Nussbaum's eschatological outlook, limited as it is within the bounds of reason alone, does not include the possibility that the creature whose biological teleology is now thwarted might one day be released in the life to come. By contrast, I am suggesting that Tolleson's case tacitly depends upon an eschatological view of human beings that transcends mere earthly citizenship. Tolleson's case for social justice for the disabled makes rational sense only if one tacitly assumes that no disability necessarily, permanently, irreversibly, or finally thwarts those radical capacities that are fully latent in our biological teleology. In other words, Tolleson's argument will be reasonable only to those who already share his conviction to view the weakest and most vulnerable members of the human community as possible candidates for heavenly citizenship. Now let us take stock. None of what I have said entails that any part of Tolleson's case is mistaken. Indeed, I'm not inclined to think that any part of it is. What my comments do entail is that Tolleson's case is incomplete. Natural reason in and of itself cannot sufficiently ground social justice for the disabled. It must be complemented by a faith that reason alone cannot provide. Apart from such a faith, Tolleson's argument, much like the actions of Jesus whose healing of the profoundly disabled were signs of the eschatological hope of the heavenly polis, will not ultimately make rational sense. But if the Apostle Paul is right, this is exactly the result that members of the heavenly polis should expect. And here I quote from the chapter 1 of 1 Corinthians, "For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even the things that are not, to bring to nothing the things that are." When approached from the vantage point of the wisdom of men, social justice for the disabled is foolishness. It is, at best, the surrender of reason to sentiment, a fact that explains the internal conflict of someone like Nussbaum. But in light of the gospel, in light of the word of the cross, of which Jesus' earthly ministry among the disabled was a prophetic sign, or if we might put it differently, in light of a distinctly Christian eschatology, one that views the lack of self-sufficiency on the part of the profoundly disabled as merely temporary, in light of the present reality of their candidacy for citizenship in the kingdom of God, Tolleson's case is completely reasonable. For our ability to ground social justice for the disabled depends not merely upon our capacity for viewing them as members of the human species, but also upon our ability to grasp the implication that said membership carries not merely earthly, but eternal significance. And the latter cannot be grasped by reason alone. Thank you.